say it was 2% of gross world product or 3% of gross world product to save the world, we're saying that it's still a small percentage of global luxury consumption. And if that burden is distributed fairly, then it wouldn't really hurt anybody to pay it, and it probably would stabilize the economy, as a matter of fact.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show. It's a rather unwieldy title, I admit, but it's designed to flag up the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, now considered to be safe, by leading climate scientist James Hansen, in the light of the rapid rate of ice melt that is now being observed in the Arctic. Yesterday, Hansen gave evidence to this effect to the House of Commons Environment Audit Committee. Hansen's appearance came on the eve of the launch of a new report entitled Climate Safety, which is pretty essential reading for anyone following these programmes, as it sets out, in an accessible way, the latest science, the scale and urgency of the task at hand, and the key solutions we need to focus on in order to achieve it. You can visit climatesafety.org and download the report for free. I'll give you that URL again at the end of the programme. At the international level, the annual UN climate talks are just about to start in Poznan, Poland, and we're going to continue our look at some of the big ideas floating around that might break the cycle of more of the same that seems to be dominating the talks currently. Greenhouse development rights, which we are going to take a look at this week, is a framework that has been worked up by a collaboration of the think tank EcoEquity in the US and the Stockholm Environment Institute. It aims to work with the grain of the negotiations and to set the scene for a global deal that would include targets and responsibilities for all countries, which are set in a way that everyone can agree are adequate and, most importantly, fair. In a sense, it is a variant of the contraction and convergence scheme proposed by the Global Commons Institute back in the 1990s, which suggested that the fairest solution was to ensure that everyone on the planet should have an equal right to emit greenhouse gases at the end of the period where global emissions contract to a level which is safe. Unlike contraction and convergence, but like Kyoto 2, which we looked at last week, GDR establishes a global fund that would help the poor to adapt to climate change, as well as help fund the transition to a low-carbon society. I spoke to Tom Athanasio, one of the authors of the GDR framework, by phone to California.
The way I'd like to explain it is we're out of time, right? We're out of time. If you believe Jim Hansen and all the stuff about fast and slow climate sensitivity, and if you're following the tipping points science, you realize that this is an emergency situation. And at the same time, there's a tremendous increase in emissions going on in the developing world as they attempt to catch up with the North. That's the problem. So what we're saying is that it's physically possible to solve the climate crisis, though only with a social mobilization that is unlike anything we've ever seen before, but that it would require a tremendous amount of political and social cooperation around the world. And that political and social cooperation is actually possible, but only if targets are allocated in a fair way and in a way that protects the poor from the climate regime itself. Martin Kaur from the Third World Network puts this very well. He says there's actually three crises. There's the climate crisis, there's the development crisis, and there's the climate policy crisis. And the climate policy crisis is that unless we do something that protects the poor by protecting their right to sustainable development, then the climate regime itself will hurt the poor by locking in their poverty forever. And as long as that threat is there, it's going to be impossible to make a deal.
Going to the kind of heart of what you're proposing in a practical sense, you've essentially come up with a formula which you call Responsibility Capacity Index. Perhaps you can explain that in simple terms.
Right. There's a lot of people in the climate debate that have their own ideas about what would be fair. We originally set out to fix contraction and convergence by taking proper account of national circumstances. And we couldn't do it for complex reasons. But what we decided instead was, look, instead of telling everybody that per capita emission rights are fair, why don't we actually take the UN negotiations and the Southern spokespeople at their word and listen to what they say is fair and what they say they want. What the South has been saying for decades now is that it wants the right to development, not equal per capita emissions rights, the right to development. And when you look at equity principles as they are embodied in the climate negotiations, they're very clearly spelled out in the Framework Convention.
The kind of climate conventions thing about protecting this climate system on the basis of equity and in accordance with common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capacities.
Exactly. What we've really done is set out to operationalize that.
Yeah, because it's always been there, but no one's really understood how to make that work, in a sense.
Exactly. That's all we've done. In a way, we've done nothing special, because it's just been laying on the table all the time, and people have been afraid to touch it.
And I guess people have been just arguing on the basis of their own interests and like kind of political horse trading, in a sense.
Well, within the negotiations, there's been a tremendous amount of political horse trading. I mean, obviously, that's what happened in 1997 when the Kyoto targets were allocated. It was done on the basis of political power. And that's why so many of us have come to agree that principles are important. I mean, normally in geopolitics, it's only the idealists who have very little contact with the actual, you know, power politics, as whatever is playing out, that care about principles. But in the climate regime, things are a bit different, because there's a widespread understanding of the fact that the global negotiation is not going to be successful if it's conducted on the basis of political horse trading. I mean, look at Kyoto. Kyoto didn't work very well, right? And what I'm hearing is that Japan has made it very, very clear that it's not going to accept another round of targets that are based on backroom deals. And that, assuming that that's true, and, you know, we could talk about why Japan is taking this position, what that means is that the next round of targets is going to have to be based on some kind of comprehensible or defensible principles. And we don't really have any principles to work with other than the official principles of the UN process.
Okay, just to perhaps clarify so that we've got it down on record, exactly what you mean by those two terms, responsibility and capacity. Responsibility is about different countries' cumulative emissions since 1990, is that correct?
Yes, that's how we define responsibility, though you have to understand that Greenhouse Development Rights is an open source policy framework, and people are absolutely free to use a different start date. And in fact, the online Greenhouse Development Rights Calculator, which is going to be released next week in Poznan, actually allows you to try out different start dates. If you think 1950 would be a better start date, or if you think 1750 would be a better start date for the accumulation of historical responsibility, you can set that date differently in the calculator. Though there's a big problem with data when you go back too far. You know, we just don't have good quantitative data. Even back to 1990, it's problematic. And there's another fairly strong argument for going back before 1990, and that's simply that lots of countries have plausible deniability. They can say, yeah, well, a few scientists knew this was a problem, but we didn't know. We don't think it's such a problem to use a relatively recent date like 1990, which can be very, very strongly defended, because the responsibility and capacity index combines the responsibility side with a capacity side. And the capacity side represents ability to pay. That is to say, wealth or income. So the big innovation that we make is to define what we call a development threshold and say that only income above the development threshold counts when calculating a country's capacity to act in the face of the climate emergency.
Okay, so development income is a kind of basic needs threshold, really.
Exactly.
You're talking about kind of $20 a day.
$20 a day.
$7,500 a year.
That's correct.
Which is like £5,000 a year
at
current
correct.
Exchange rates. And that is roughly what is calculated to meet people's basic needs.
As far as we can tell, with a fairly extensive drill down into the international literature, it's about the point where you start getting discretionary spending. So that in India and China, the point at which people have enough to eat, have access to fresh water, have a bicycle, maybe have a shelter that they can, it's about $7,500. Maybe that's the point where the household buys its first cell phone. What I mean, it's not anything that we would recognize as a luxurious lifestyle, but it's not real poverty either. So we say that at that point, people start paying a little bit, just a little bit, to deal with the climate emergency. And again, the development threshold is just a parameter. If you think $7,500 U.S. is too low, you can set it higher in the calculator. But the point is that development emissions, if you will, should be protected from the demands of the climate regime. The real point we're making is that even if the most aggressive estimates of the cost of an emergency climate transition are to be believed. I mean, Stern said maybe 2% of gross world product for 450 to 500 CO2 equivalent stabilization. We're after 350 CO2, which is 400 CO2 equivalent, so maybe it'll be more than 2% of gross world product. And there's huge uncertainties anyways. But say it was 2% of gross world product or 3% of gross world product to save the world. We're saying that it's still a small percentage of global luxury consumption. That's really what we're saying. And that if that burden is distributed fairly, then it wouldn't really hurt anybody to pay it, and it probably would, stabilize the economy, as a matter of fact. But you can't ask the poor to pay it. It's not their fault, and they don't have the capacity or responsibility to pay it.
Okay. Using your figures to plug into the calculator, you've got a table in your executive summary which shows what the U.S. might be expected to pay into the Global Climate Fund. They would have a responsibility of about 32%. And if the fund was $1 trillion, that would be $320 billion a year.
That is correct.
And the EU, $250 billion a year. The UK, $36 billion a year, something like that. And, I mean, in the case of the US and the UK, that's roughly, half of what they've been using to bail out the banks recently?
Yes, that's right. You can do it all in bailout units. Roughly half is actually an interesting way to put it, because the total estimate of the amount of money that's been put into the bailout so far is about $4 trillion U.S.
In terms of targets, I got a little bit confused along the way with the U.S., for example, when you've allocated targets to different countries. Am I right in thinking that by 2025 the U.S. will have a bigger reduction target than it actually has in terms of its own emissions?
Right, that's another interesting result of the GDER's approach, which is that when you run the numbers, you find that the rich countries, each country is somewhat different, but in general, the obligations of the rich countries increase year by year. This is under a 2-degree emergency emissions reduction pathway. Their obligations increase until at about the year 2020 to 2025, they equal the size of current national emissions, and they continue to increase so that, for example, in 2030 or 2040, the United States has, in effect, a negative emissions budget. It has to pay other countries to mitigate on its behalf in order to reach its obligations. The new language that we're trying to introduce is that countries have dual obligations. They have obligations to mitigate domestically, and they also have international obligations.
Yeah.
Okay? And those international obligations are not offsets. They are in addition to domestic mitigation obligations, and that the two obligations together can yield a mitigation obligation that exceeds the size of a country's total emissions.
Okay.
In fact, that's how the system works. That's how the emergency program is mobilized. It's very consistent with the architecture that's implicit in the Bali Action Plan. So, you know, it's currently unrealistic, but the thing you have to understand is it's not unrealistic because it's arguably fair or because it's principle-based. It's unrealistic because the cap itself is unrealistic. The fundamental reality we have to deal with is that 300 to 350, to use the name of your show, is an unrealistic target. It's a target that cannot be reached under the sign of politics as usual. And our claim is simply that in order to drive this kind of an emergency mobilization, the targets have to be set in a way that's transparently, comprehensively fair around the world.
If we can just look at how China would be affected in terms of targets as well. China would have to make a certain amount of cuts in, say, 2025, but the US at that time might also want to make some of its extra cuts in China. So it would have the right to receive help to make additional cuts from other countries, which would far outweigh the emissions cuts that it would be having to make as a target as well.
Yes, I think that's right. What happens to China is very interesting. In 2010, China has about 5% of the global responsibility and capacity. In 2020, it has about 10% of the global responsibility and capacity. And in 2030, it has about 15% of the total global responsibility and capacity. Meanwhile, between 2010 and 2030, the U.S. share of total global RCI drops from 33% to 24%. So you can see that as wealth is redistributed around the world by the rise of Asian capitalism, the RCI is automatically redistributed because it's based on capacity, and capacity is defined in terms of income. And so that's an interesting result. It's a result that makes it possible to go to the capitals of the North and say, look, this is not letting China off the hook. And they say, but it's so small. You say, yeah, well, China is still a poor country. We look at all these rich bastards in Shanghai driving around in their SUVs and going to their malls and carrying their knockoff Gucci bags. But that doesn't mean that all the Chinese are wealthy. It doesn't mean that all the Chinese have joined the global consuming class, only that some of them have joined.
You said earlier on that some NGOs have been warming to the idea, and the coalition that represents the NGOs at the negotiations, the Climate Action Network, seems up until now to have been trying to do the best within the current framework and trying to tweak it to the best advantage of the constituents it's representing. But can you see room for that changing and for your ideas in particular to be taken on board?
You know, it's interesting that you asked this question. This could be a whole show. because as the climate movement grows, there's a lot of different ideas about how to move forward. My view is that we have to really think about the climate movement and what needs to be done strategically in order to grow it into an effective movement that can work both inside and outside the negotiations. And CAN is fundamentally, if I may state my own opinion, it's fundamentally a tactical organization. You know, it fights trench warfare, article by article, meeting by meeting, country by country. And believe me, we would be in a lot worse situation than we are today if we didn't have the Climate Action Network. And it's because of the fact that CAN is such a large, unwieldy NGO network that we are basically organizing a Friends of Greenhouse Development Rights circle, if you will, which is quite informal. And there's a lot of support within Greenpeace. There's a lot of support within Oxfam. There's a lot of support within Friends of the Earth. The Heinrich Böll Foundation, which is the German Green Foundation, is a big supporter of ours. Christian Aid, which is based in London, is a big supporter of the Greenhouse Development Rights approach. And in fact, the whole ecumenical network across Northern Europe, you know, the sister organizations of Christian Aid are supporting the GDR's approach. There was a big meeting about it in China last week where we're in correspondence with quite a number of delegates. So it's a very, very complex map, and everything within the climate negotiations and within the climate movement is changing very, very rapidly. And it would be a good situation if we had more time. Do you know what I mean? Because politically, if you look at it compared to normal processes, the learning curve is very, very steep, and the debate is changing. Every 3 months, it's a somewhat different debate than it was 3 months before, and yet we have so little time. And the problem is, from the Copenhagen perspective, how are we going to negotiate something which can really start driving a sustainable downturn in global emissions and set us up for a true global grand bargain in the third commitment period or as soon as possible after Copenhagen? The question really is, can we take advantage of the economic crisis in the context of the Copenhagen deadline to negotiate some sort of a bridge agreement that is principle-based, but not going so far as to impose agreements on the developing countries that they, for good reasons, are not yet willing to accept?
The main stumbling block with this proposal, presumably, would be that rich countries will just think that it's asking too much of them.
Four-country negotiators are not necessarily... You know, we have a game of chicken going on, Phil, okay? We have a game of chicken going on. The northern countries have these immense obligations, but they're only immense from the standards of politics as usual, economics as usual. If you compare them to the obligations to the size of their total economies, they're not immense. And as I said, the cost of saving the world is a small fraction of global luxury consumption, and we really must keep that in mind. And in the developing world, they're terrified for very good reasons. There's no historical precedent for true development that isn't carbon-based. And they have no good reason to believe that they're going to be able to provide energy services for their people without carbon emissions. So they're terrified. This is fundamentally a problem of international cooperation. And so, you know, the Europeans, frankly, would like to go further than they're currently going, but they think they need some developing country to say, we'll go along with you on this journey. But the developing countries are afraid of getting screwed, and as well they should be, because Europe, though it's a good guy in the climate negotiations, is not a good guy in the trade negotiation. It's always trying to break the South's negotiational solidarity when it comes to things like agricultural subsidies. So, you know, we have to go through a period of trust building now. It's very, very important that the rich countries do something grand and make some sort of commitment to support the South in an extremely rapid process of decarbonization. And if we do, if we can rise to that occasion, I think that we'll find that Southern partners emerge. The South Africans certainly have made it very, very clear that they want to decarbonize their economy. The Chinese action plan is very impressive. The Indians plan to put a gigawatt of PV production capacity online every year from now on. There's a lot of desire to move. The question is, what's the political deal that's going to make it possible? And really, our claim is simply that that political deal is not going to occur save in the presence of a clear understanding that the climate regime is not going to compromise the right to sustainable development. If we could just establish that, that nobody wants to save the world on the backs of the poor people, that the climate regime isn't going to lock in the divide between the rich and the poor. If we could just establish that, we could break the impasse.
That was Tom Athanasiou of EcoEquity, co-author of the Greenhouse Development Rights Framework, speaking on the phone from California. The second edition of the GDR book is about to be released at the UN Talks in Poznan, and the book will be available for free download at greenhousedevelopmentrights.org shortly. And just a reminder that the Climate Safety Report I mentioned at the top of the programme is available from climatesafety.org. If you'd like to hear this programme again, or listen to any of the other programmes from Climate Radio's extensive archive, point your web browser to climateradio.co.uk. Thanks for listening.